Yes, I'm your host, Yanuk. We're going to engage in conversation with one of my favorite people, IQ Al-Rasuli, in a moment. IQ sent me a YouTube video a couple of days ago. It was a gentleman that I assume is a British politician. His name is Paul Weston. If you were to Google Paul Weston, I am a racist YouTube, you would probably find it. We're going to play a significant part of that this morning. But before we do, IQ, first welcome to the program. My pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
IQ, you and I took a different approach to exposing and condemning Islam than did Paul Weston. Our approach was quite similar, but different in only one aspect. Your book, Lifting the Veil, The True Faces of Muhammad and Islam, that comes in three volumes, Lifting the Veil, The True Faces of Muhammad and Islam, by IQ Al-Rasuli, it presents what is known about Muhammad from the Quran and Hadith in a topical arrangement. In other words, you picked topics that you thought would be interesting for your readers to know, and then you presented the evidence that is known about things like who is a Muslim, who is Allah, the condition of women in Islam, what is the nature of jihad and Islam? Was Muhammad a prophet? That's a topical arrangement of the evidence, and the evidence that you cite is almost universally from the Quran and Hadith. Is that a reasonable summation of your books?
It's perfect, yes.
Okay, all right. My approach to Islam was slightly different than yours, but only slightly. I came to recognize that there were only five books chronicling the rise of Islam and Muhammad's life that were written within 200 to 250 years of Muhammad's life and death. And that the best known of them is the Quran, but the problem with the Quran is that it has no context. Context only comes in two varieties. There's topical context, which is what you use to write your book. A lot of books are written topically. Very logical way to present material. The other way that the books are written is chronologically. The Quran is neither chronological nor topical. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct.
Right. It's just kind of like you were to take sayings, they would get caught up in a tornado, and wherever they fall, you kind of put them together.
Well, I call them a toss salad.
Yeah, toss salad. That's fine. Toss salad. All right. So I'm got a lot of faults, but one of the things that I really like is I like order. I like to make connections. I like to do things that are logical and rational, particularly as it relates to understanding something. So I approach the Quran, and it's a toss salad. My inclination is to resolve that by using whatever can be found that would have credibility to either organize it topically or organize it by chronology. And what I found is that there were two highly credible sources regarding Islam that would allow me to take the Quran and reorganize it chronologically. One of them was the first published book on Islam, which is the Sirah, or biography of Muhammad as compiled by Ibn Ishaq, and the most comprehensive is the Tariq, the history of Islam, compiled by Al-Tabari. Both of those sources are as credible as any that can be found in Islam. In fact, I would go as far as to say, without those two sources and the presentation they provide of Islam's formation and Muhammad's life, Islam as a religion could not be practiced.
In fact, Islam would not exist without these two.
Yeah, that's correct. Islam would literally not exist without the Sirah, the biography of Muhammad compiled by Ibn Ishaq, and without the history of Islam's formation by Tabari. And both of those books are really nothing more than a chronological presentation of Hadith, correct?
Correct.
All right.
Yep.
Okay, in the past, Let me list the other two sources. Those other two sources are arranged the same way you arrange your book, Lifting the Veil, which is topically. There are topical arrangements of these hadith compiled by Bukhari and by Muslim. And Bukhari and Muslim's topical arrangements of hadith are considered the most sacrosanct, the most trusted, the most revered in Islam. Is that also true?
Yes, that's why they call them sahih. Sahih means perfectly correct.
Okay. So the only thing that I would like to add to this is a conversation you and I have had in the past. I came to the conclusion as I studied the Quran and the Hadith that there really is no difference between the Quran and Hadith, that the Quran is Hadith and the Hadith are Quran. Quran means to recite, and Hadith is oral reports. So the Quran and the Hadith came from exactly the same person, didn't it?
From Muhammad.
Yeah. Then they were retained the same way by the same people, passed on to us in the same way, orally, to the same people, before they were actually written down. Is that also correct?
That's correct.
So the Quran and Hadith come from exactly the same person, and they were retained and passed on to us in exactly the same way.
Correct.
And they cover the same material, do they not?
Exactly the same material.
Okay. So there really is no difference between Quran and Hadith. If the Hadith are untrustworthy, the Quran is untrustworthy. If the Quran is untrustworthy, so are the Hadith. They come from the same source, passed on to us the same way, cover the same material. Now, what I did is rather than arrange the material by topic, I arranged the material chronologically in Prophet of Doom. So I used the biography of Muhammad, the history of Islam, to put the Quran in chronological order and to set it into the context of Muhammad's life. And it is by doing so that I expose and condemn Islam. Because when you see the Quran set into the context of Muhammad's life, it is a stunningly repulsive presentation. I mean, Muhammad was amongst the most perverted men to ever live. He was a pedophile, he was a racist, he was a rapist, he was incestuous, he was a mass murderer, he was a ruthless terrorist, he was a slave trader, he was a kidnapper, he was a thief, he was an avowed liar. Is there any one of those things that I've said that isn't verified in the Hadith and Quran?
Not one of them. No. Every single item, every adjective you shower on Muhammad is explained fully in the Hadith and Quran.
Okay, so the only difference between your book, Lifting the Veil, which exposes and condemns Islam topically, and my book, Prophet of Doom, which exposes and condemns Islam chronologically, is both of us used exactly the same materials, the oldest Islamic sources, and we just presented the material in a different way, topically versus chronologically. But since we relied exclusively on the oldest Islamic sources, is there any way for a Muslim to refute either book without completely undermining the credibility of their religion?
No chance in hell. In fact, both books together destroy Islam. If individually they destroy Islam, but together they completely annihilate Islam.
Right. And there is literally no response that a Muslim can give to either of them that is logical, informed, or rational, because since both are based exclusively on the oldest Islamic sources, if you say that the sources aren't true, then what do you have left?
They've got nothing.
And if the sources are true, what does it mean?
How evil, how dastardly, how degenerate Islam is.
Right. Now, that's not the approach that Paul Weston took, is it?
He's using a completely Western mind.
Right. Now, with Paul, and by the way, it's interesting, your topical arrangement of the information comes because you were born in Iraq. That's your country. You actually approach this material from the mindset of the Arab mindset, if you will. And I approached it from a philosophical, rational, logical mindset, might be the Greek mindset, if you will. But today's world, neither of the two approaches we took is particularly popular. The approach that Paul Weston took is the approach of, all I have to do is look around. If you look at the 50 countries that are Islamic, they're hell on earth. You know, they treat women like rubbish. They offer no freedoms.
They treat being like rubbish, with all due respect, not only women.
Right.
Look
yes.
what they're doing in Syria. Look what they're doing in Iraq. Look what they're doing
right.
in Yemen.
Yeah, you look at it's Syria. It's Muslim against Muslim civil war. And it's not just that they have killed, as he mentions, 100,000 people. It's the savagery and the brutality of it, where they have both sides targeted civilians, both sides have engaged young children, both sides have wantonly raped thousands of women. Both sides will tear the heart out of a victim and eat it. I mean, the savagery that goes along with the civil war there, and it's just between two sects of Islam, Shia and Sunni. He says, you know, that ought to be enough for you to know you don't want this in your country, right?
Right.
You know, then he looks at the disingenuousness of the revolution in Egypt, where a fundamentalist Muslim came to power, and how that country has gone to the point of from near bankrupt to bankrupt, and how that country has lost all of its freedoms as a direct result of that. And he says, why would you want that as part of your country?
The same thing is happening in Turkey, by the way.
Of course, where Turkey was founded as a secular state and no longer is. Turkey is a democracy only in the sense that that the vast majority of Turks now are fundamentalist Muslims, as are the vast majority of Muslims around the world. They're fundamentalists, and the fundamentalists are told by their imam to go vote for the most fundamentalist candidate, and they do. And so Turkey has really become an Islamic theocracy, has it not?
It is. It really is. Irrespective of what people think, especially the Obama administration and the Western mind, it is remarkable how the Western mind has completely denied the facts and reality. This is beyond comprehension.
Yes. You know, it's also interesting that we don't read anything more about Turkey in terms of the secular protest that took place in Turkey. Turkey was the only country where there was a secular protest. And you and I both said the same thing, that it has no chance of success because unlike the Islamic protests that swept the Islamic world, where they represented the three-quarter majority of the people, and they got what they wanted, they prevailed and imposed fundamentalist Islamic states in those countries. In the case of Turkey, the protesters, as secular protesters, represent less than 20% of the population, and therefore there was no chance that they were going to prevail, and they didn't. We're going to return with IQ Al-Rasuli in a moment, and when we do, we're going to play an audio of Paul Weston admitting that he is an Islamophobe and explaining why. Please stay tuned to IQ Al-Rasuli and Paul Weston. Hello and welcome back to Shatteriness. I'm your host, Yada. We're here with IQ Al-Rasuli. We're going to play a clip from Paul Weston. We're going to introduce that. Let me introduce that clip because we're going to cut in at about the minute 45-second mark. The reason we're going to cut in into it, first of all, the whole clip is way too long to play even during this segment. But the second is he says many times, I am a racist. But he's saying I am a racist in the with tongue fully planted in his cheek, which may not come across to listeners unfamiliar with British humor. He says that, you know, I'm a racist because, well, the left calls me a racist, the BBC calls me a racist, and he lists all these different people that call him a racist, and he's not a racist. The definition of a racist is someone who wishes harm on a race, but his issue is a religion, not a race. From there,
people call him a racist. That he must be.
That he must be one. He must be one. But he's saying that with tongue firmly planted in his cheek. Say, okay, think, people, think. Just because there's group thought here, you ought not buy into it. He then transitions to, I must also be a homophobe, and that's where we're going to begin the clip. Islamophobe.
I'm probably
when
also
I say home.
I'm probably also an Islamophobe. A phobia is an irrational fear of something. Now, I don't have an irrational fear of Islam. I look around the world today, at Syria at the moment, where almost 100,000 people have been killed in the last 2 years, where Shia Muslims are slaughtering Sunni Muslims and vice versa. I look at places like Indonesia and Egypt and China and the Philippines. Everywhere you look, you see problems with Islam. And they're violent. They are, dare I say it, to really reinforce my racist credentials, a thoroughly savage political and religious ideology. Now, many people will disagree with that. The far left, of course, will say you cannot criticize Islam because Islam is a religion and rules have now been put into place in this country that say if you criticize it, you are guilty of inciting religious hatred. But Islam is not just a religion. Islam is a political ideology as well, and we need to call it out on the fact that it is also political. It is a culture that is both political and religious. And I would like to know if I'm able to say certain things about it. You know, we have a huge problem in this country that is not going to go away. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. We as a people are declining as a demographic, and the Islamic population is growing 9 times faster than any other. And when I look to the future, I see a full-blown religious civil war occurring in this country. The unthinkable things that are going on in somewhere like Syria today will happen in this country before 2040, certainly before 2050. And I don't want Britain to turn into a country like that. So I'm going to denounce Islam as a backward, savage political and religious ideology, and to hell with what anybody thinks about that, because if we don't do something about it, we are going to be involved in something that most people can barely even begin to imagine.
Wow. IQ, I've heard you speak of the motivations for writing your series of books, Lifting the Veil, The True Faces of Muhammad and Islam. Do you think he's right? Do you think that if people do not denounce Islam, that the world is going to see savagery and war beyond our imagination?
Absolutely right. I prepared a talk, if I may, later on. To you give me a few minutes regarding
yes.
exactly this subject.
Yes, in fact, I'd love to listen to it because I've asked you in the past, you know, IQ, why did you risk your life to expose and condemn Islam? To do so, I mean, I've received thousands of death threats, and I did not grow up in an Islamic country. So, you know, it's the venom that a Muslim will show to someone who is fluent in Arabic and grew up in an Islamic country that denounces Islam is much greater than the venom that is spewed my way with thousands of death threats. So, yeah, I asked you, why did you do it? And you said to not do it is to recognize that the world's going to be involved in world war as a direct consequence of this religion, and it's so savage it's hard to imagine. But
yes,
sure, please.
Yes, exactly what you said. Because sitting on the line on the fence and do nothing, we are complicit in aiding and abetting the very people we abhor.
Yes. In fact, IQ, when we return from the break, the platform will be yours. I want to hear what you have to say as it relates to this specific subject, which is that if we do not collectively take the risk to accept the burden of exposing and condemning Islam, that the future of this world is going to be unimaginably savage. We'll return to Shattering Myths. A moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. We're talking with IQ Al-Rasouli after listening to a stunning presentation by a British politician. His name is Paul Weston. And Paul Weston said, in essence, that if we don't open our eyes and recognize how savage Islam is, how horrible the conditions are in Islamic countries, and how Islam is so responsible for terrorism around the globe, and that it is growing because of the birth rate, if we don't stand up to it and expose it and condemn it, that our future is going to be hellish. that the savagery of war that Islam is going to breed will be beyond our imagination. And I know this is the reason that IQ Al-Rasuli speaks on the radio, on shows like this, and has written his books. So, IQ, please share with us your thoughts regarding the realization that if we don't confront Islam, it will consume us.
Dear listeners, a curtain of fear has descended on the intelligentsia of the West. It is the irrational fear of being misunderstood as Islamophobic, which has sealed their lips, dried their pens, and locked their keyboards. Writers, politicians, and media have imposed a frightening censorship on themselves, refusing to speak their minds, thus ensuring that the only voices being heard are those of the Muslim fundamentalists. How are we to defeat an enemy our leaders refuse to name? I never would have believed possible that an entire continent, whether it's Europe or America, can be clinically brain dead. Obviously, not all of them are this way, but enough people consent with their silence to keep these treasonous fools in office. Ladies and gentlemen, there cannot ever be democracy in Islam, because that would mean that people have the right to challenge Allah and to decide in His stead. This is inadmissible, and this heresy will never be allowed under Sharia. Just listen to the anthem of fundamentalist Muslims in every country on earth where they live. They shout out loud in public, Allah is our objective. Muhammad is our prophet. The Quran is our law. Jihad is our way, and dying in the way of Allah, wal mawtu fi sabilillah, is our highest aspiration. At first, one might think that Islamism is an ideology, a policy, or a line of thought. This is a very simplistic point of view of political orthodoxy, conventional wisdom, and or ideas. It is imperative. We must see Islam through the lens of a microscope, as in biology. I'll tell you why. Contrary to common perceptions, Islam is not an issue of faith and belief. Islam is a virulent virus, a deadly disease, which intends to devastate and or to devour the whole world. The name of this virulent virus is Quran. It is propagated in mosques and madrasas by the mullahs and imams, who indoctrinate susceptible and innocent children into Sharia. This virus is so powerful, it instantly eradicates the areas of the brain of the believer or convert that deal with logic, with mercy and compassion, turning the victim or host into a living dead, a zombie. Sharia is, after all, hate-mongering, racist, duplicitous, intolerant, warmongering, misogynist, disloyal, vile, merciless, and is totally ungodly. Thus calling Islam peaceful or a religion rank as two of the most egregious lies that have ever been insinuated into the human consciousness. In the warped and twisted mind, the mindset of the politically correct liberals, unlimited tolerance is a virtue. Stupid people that they are. Because in fact and in reality, unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. Because, as I've said it before, if we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the all sorts of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. We should therefore claim, in the name of tolerance, the right not to tolerate the intolerant. This axiom was spoken by a man called Karl Popper. Hence, we must never tolerate the intolerance of Islam and Sharia, nor allow them to soil our soil. Back to you, sir.
IQ, well spoken. If we come down with cancer, and we leave that cancer unchecked, what happens?
We die.
And so when it comes to a disease like cancer, is not the only way to fight it to confront it?
Of course, you have to.
Right.
If you want to survive, you have to.
If you have a disease of the human mind and soul that leads that says that its greatest desire is to engage in jihad, which is fighting, and to die killing for Allah. Is there any way for humanity to survive that disease if it doesn't confront it?
If it doesn't confront it, humanity would be destroyed.
Islam cannot conquer the world, but it can destroy it.
In fact, that is exactly what they're doing. They're not conquering the world. They're destroying it.
Correct. All you have to do is look at an Islamic country to see what the result would be if they prevail in your own. They don't create something that is worthwhile. You want to know what hell's like? Go visit an Islamic country. You'll find it there. The reality is that what we have created as a result of political correctness in our universities, going back into the late 18th century, is the sense that has permeated Britain, which is why Paul Weston spoke out. It is what you were speaking of in your presentation there, IQ, is that we are being encouraged to stop being judgmental and to accept everything, to tolerate everything. But if you tolerate a disease like cancer, if you tolerate a terrorist manifesto, what happens?
We get destroyed.
Yes. Islam is going to destroy not only us, but also them. They're destroying themselves right now. But it's like all diseases, though. A disease passes from one host to another. You know, we can't put up fences that are tall enough to constrain this disease. IQ, I have long said, and I have a lot of people that disagree with me on this, but I have long said that it is impossible to prevail against Islam with bullets and bombs. That when you attack a religion with bullets and bombs, you embolden it because zealots want to die for their cause. I've long said that I thought the most effective way to confront Islam, the most effective weapon, is words wielded based upon the truth, to present evidence and to use reason. What do you think? Can words be wielded in such a way that Islam is exposed and condemned and therefore thwarted, or is the best approach bullets and bombs?
There is no way on earth we can destroy them with bullets and bombs, and there is no need to destroy them with bullets and bombs. Your methodology, my methodology, is to expose Islam for what it is, and this will destroy Islam. But we need the support of the media. We need the support of academia. We need the support of people who are
politicians.
Indoctrinated, politically correct.
Yeah, politicians. Now, one of the things that is interesting, and Paul Weston made it very clear. One of the reasons in Prophet of Doom that I devoted 77 pages of Prophet of Doom was to comparing quotes from the Islamic Quran and Hadith to Hitler's Mein Kampf, was to show that really Islam is extraordinarily similar to Nazism, and that with Nazism we feel comfortable condemning it. And yet, Hitler wrote of Nazism in Mein Kampf that the thing that he had to impose for Nazism to prevail was called the Volks religion, the people's religion, and that Nazism was a religion. And in that regard, both religion, political, patriotic, and military movement, really, is Islam any different than Nazism?
Not an iota of difference.
No.
And you say in your book, her Muhammad and her Hitler are the same.
They're the same. Their message is the same. I mean, apart from time and race, the message is identical in Mein Kampf. As a matter of fact, when Hitler was looking for credibility, the source of credibility was Islam. He spoke of Mecca. He spoke of Muhammad. He modeled Nazism on Islam. And since, so why is it that in the West people are willing to expose and condemn Nazism, which was equal parts religion and politics and militarism, and they're not willing to expose Islam, which is equal parts religion, politics, and militarism?
Well, I can't call them naive. I call them stupid. Really, there's nothing less than stupidity to stand in front of a train at 50 miles an hour and think nothing will happen to you.
Yeah, if I hold out a flower and an olive branch to the train and make it look like I want to welcome them, how is that going to influence the damage that train is going to do to you when it runs over you?
Well, you'd be beyond recognition. It doesn't matter, does it?
Right. There are three approaches to the train. You can follow the popular approach, which is to say, I'm going to tolerate and accept the religion while it murders me and everything and destroys everything I love. You can step out of the way of the train and just let it go by and murder everybody else and destroy everything else that you've held dear. Or you can try to derail the train. Are those not the choices?
These are the choices.
And so the
choices. People are not even making choices.
Right. Now, in this particular case, the reason we devote an hour every week to exposing and condemning Islam is that while there's a lot of things wrong with the world, there is nothing wrong with the world that's going to be as catastrophic as the academia, the media, politicians universally embracing and accepting and going further. I mean, the President of the United States speaks of Islam as a great religion. He does everything in his power to exonerate and to lift up this religion. The result of that is going to be exactly what Paul Weston promised. Hell on earth, world war, devastation, vastly more savage than what we're witnessing in Syria, because it will be worldwide. Now, why, IQ, don't more people engage to derail this train? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. We have Glenn back on the phone. I'm going to go to Glenn in just a second. We have IQ with us. IQ, the reality is that if once you study how despicable Muhammad really was, and the fact that his example, which Muslims are ordered to follow, was that of a ruthless terrorist and mass murderer, and that according to Muhammad's testimony in the Quran, the only guaranteed admittance into the Islamic paradise, where you're satiated with multiple virgins and rivers that flow with wine, a typical brothel, if you will, is to die in the process of killing peaceful Muslims and non-Muslims. If that religion continues to exist unchecked, then the world is going to be enveloped in a war that is being manifest before our eyes. In one country, in Syria, the savagery of the rapes of the children being tortured and brought into this war and used as human shields and used as soldiers, of people, parents being tortured in front of their children, of the constant rapes of women, of the torturous deaths of those innocent bystanders in the war, where no matter who wins, the conditions in Syria will continue to be hellish. That is what we're going to see around the entire world, is it not?
In China, as we speak, in the northwestern territory in Xinjiang, the Muslims went on the rampage.
Yes.
And the Chinese are not politically correct.
Right.
They gave them back 10 times what they started.
Right. Well, you look at Paul Weston mentioned Indonesia. Indonesia, you look at what happened in East Timor, where the Indonesian Muslims perpetrated genocide and killed 250,000 Catholics, just wiping them out because they didn't want anyone other than a Muslim to live in territory they had confiscated.
And yet Obama is the one who is telling us, and the Western media are telling us, and the Western politicians are telling us how great Islam is.
You came from Iraq. How many Christians were there in Iraq before the U.S. invasion?
Well, in the year 2000, 2003, 1.3 million. Today, 200,000.
So that's genocide. That's an annihilation. Yeah, it's genocide. It's an annihilation. What happened when the Turks lost against the Russians in World War One and needed some bloodlust to quell their frustration, and they were marching back into to Turkey? What did they do to the Christian population?
1.5 million Armenians. Right. 1.5 million Armenians.
Right. What will happen in Syria, IQ, if the Sunni rebels, the fundamentalist Muslims, prevail?
They are already killing Christians.
Right.
Tens of thousands of Christians are running away from Syria.
These things known, Glenn, I'd love for you to, I think you have a point you'd like to make relative to Islam. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, just a real quickie. You know, may Yahweh bless your efforts to expose and oppose Islam. However, be advised, we know that the prescribed means of capital punishment for those who refuse the mark of the beast will be decapitation. One might want to spend a little time speculating about what one might be inferring
from
this.
Yeah, that's interesting. What Glenn is saying, IQ, is that the mark of the beast, which, by the way, if you look at it in the oldest manuscripts of Revelation, is actually written to look identical to "in the name of Allah." It's not written in Greek. It's written in a script that looks like it reads "in the name of Allah," being the mark of the beast. But the penalty for not accepting the beast in prophetic prophecy here, mark, is decapitation. What is the signature move of Islam for those that don't acquiesce and agree to show their loyalty to Allah and Islam? What do they do?
Always decapitation.
Right. You know, as a matter of fact, when you look at the prophecies regarding the last days and the religion and political integration that's going to prevail in those days and the proclivities of the Torahless one during those days, boy, I tell you what, it's awful hard not to see a lot of Islam in the mix. As a matter of fact, the war that you and I are talking about is the Magog War in the prophetic scripture. It's all Islamic countries that they unite against Israel, and they lose. But they don't lose because this time it isn't a matter of Israel being able to respond and rebuff them. It's God himself doing so. IQ, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for sending the Paul Weston quote. Thank you for being so well prepared to respond. I've enjoyed every moment of today.
Thank you for having me.